So good evening, everyone. And I hadn't originally planned to give these particular readings, but then at some point it dawned on me that tomorrow is Canada Day. And I noticed that I've gotten increasingly uncomfortable with the whole idea of celebrating Canada Day. In view of our history of racial discrimination against Canada's Indigenous people. And I find it somewhat irksome that we celebrate Canada, that it's 154 years old, when that's really just the history of us white settler people. You know, in fact, this country was really very old and it's been inhabited for thousands of years by the Indigenous people. So last year I did a reading by an author, Richard Wagamese, and I chose him again, it's from a different book. It's called One Native Life. And it's a collection of short stories. It's autobiographical. But it also speaks to the bigger issues of being human in this world. So Wagamese was Ojibwe, originally from Ontario, but he lived in BC for at least the last 15 years of his life. He actually was he lived in Paul Lake, which is outside Kamloops, for the last, I think, since 2005. Sadly, he died in 2017 at the young age of 61, apparently of natural causes, in his sleep. And he's, if you've ever heard or read the novel Indian Horse, that's his book, which was a finalist in Canada Reads in 2013, the CBC, you know, competition for books. And then that book was actually made into a movie. And I haven't seen it, but I think it's quite good. Like so many other Native people, he suffered trauma as a young child at the hands of his own family, who were survivors of residential schools, and then ended up in a string of foster homes and was eventually adopted by non-Indigenous people in Ontario. And he did suffer from substance abuse. He had those issues most of his life and suffered also from PTSD. But despite all of this, his writing really, to me, engenders positivity and hope. And that's one of the reasons I chose him. So here goes. So the first story I'm going to read to you is called The Flag on the Mountain. Someone has put a flag on the mountain. It flaps and waves high above the lake, up where they helicopter logged a few years back. Getting it up there must have taken gumption, and the scarlet and white, hard against the green, is a statement to that grit. Seeing that flag takes me back. Everything out on the land has a tendency to do. Victoria Day, 1965. I've just been adopted and moved from Northern Ontario to Bradford, a small town an hour's drive from Toronto. By the time the holiday rolled around, I'd been in my new home about a month. There was nothing left of the world I had known for the first 9 years of my life. Bradford was on the edge of the Holland Marsh. There, the land was flat, treeless, devoted to the reaping of vegetables. The water flowed through irrigation canals, all brown and muddy. There was no bush, no pink granite outcroppings, no cliffs overlooking a lake, no open vistas. Life among the Martians felt restrictive and colorless. There was a gaping hole in me that I had once used the land to fill. In the school where they sent me, I was the only Indian kid. In fact, I was the only brown face. The Martians were pale, with names like McLaughlin, Reed, Carpenter, and Wesley. Sitting in the tight formal rows of Bradford Elementary School, I was weird, exotic, and more than a little uncomfortable. In the class photos from that year, I stuck out in the sea of white faces like a fence post in a field of snow. It was lonely, but there was no one to tell. I didn't know how to move in Bradford. It was a loopy feeling, like in a dream, when every placing of your foot is weightless. The edges of my body had become blurred, and I couldn't find a space to hold me. Even the language, the colloquial urban schoolboy rap, was new and hard on my ears. Then one day, the teacher announced the upcoming Queen's Birthday, as we called it then. She went on to explain that Bradford would raise the new Canadian flag for the first time on the Friday before the holiday weekend. There would be a band, the mayor would speak, and a special ceremony would mark the raising of the brand new Canadian symbol, which Prime Minister Pearson had pushed through Parliament several months earlier. The school wanted someone very special to raise a flag, the teacher said. The principal and the mayor had chosen me. She said, my people represented the original face of Canada and they wanted to honor that. But when the day came, I was nervous. There was going to be a news photographer at the ceremony and my picture would be in the paper. I was dressed in new clothes and my shoes were shined. My adopted parents instructed me severely in how to behave. Up in front of that big crowd, I sat in my chair, barely able to listen to the speeches. Then someone called my name. The band struck up the first notes of O Canada. My hands grasped the lanyard. As the song began to swell, I hauled on that rope. The flag inched up the pole and caught in the breeze, fluttered and began to wave. As I watched it gain the sky, I did feel honored. I was filled with a crazy sense of possibility, as if that flag could make anything happen. Right then, I believed that Canada was a wish, a breath waiting to be exhaled. I believed that the song was a blessing, the flag its standard. I believed, as I had been told by the teacher, that my people were special, that I was special, and that the blessings of that song and that flag fell equally on my shoulders. The true North, strong and free. Since then, I have learned that the national anthem can be a dirge at times, a wail, a cry in the night. I have learned that hidden in the thunder of the trumpets and the snap of the drums are common voices hollering to be heard. The flag is a symbol of the separation between red and white. It is usually ironic because of that. But I love this country. I love that flag. The majority of Native people do. Every land claim, every barricade, every protest is less a harangue for rights and property than it is a beseeching for the promise offered in that flag, represented by it. Equality, a shared vision, a shared responsibility, a wish, a held breath waiting to be exhaled. The flag above the lake flaps in the breeze of this mountain morning over everything, over everyone. So that line, hidden in the thunder of the trumpets and the snap of the drums, are common voices hollering to be heard. And this really speaks to that discomfort that I feel around, you know, celebrating Canada Day with the gay sort of celebratory nature, the flags, the parades, the fireworks, the cheers. There's this sense that something is missing, that people are being left out, forgotten. Because celebrating 154 years of Canadian existence is really the history of us white settlers, and really completely ignores the existence of the first people on this land. And that comment that Wagamese made about the flag being a symbol of the separation between red and white, I thought that was very interesting. So it's like the separation between red people and white people. And I found out a bit of trivia about Wagamese that was kind of related to this. He loved the color pink. I thought, how perfect. You know, red and white blended together is pink. And it, to me, that's a representative of him, because to me, Wagamese really had a foot in both worlds, in the world of the native people and the world of the non-native. So the next story is called To Love This Country. Sometimes you breathe this country in, and the air that is wild, free, and open, like a ragged song. I've heard that song in a thousand places. In 1987, when I was a struggling freelance journalist, I tracked down a famous artist then ensconced in the Jasper Park Lodge and made arrangements to interview him, driving north from Calgary through Banff and then on through the glistening glory of the Columbia ice field. I felt the power of the landscape all around me. 20 miles south of Jasper, I stopped to rest. I walked through the woods towards the sound of waterfalls and what I found there was magnificent. I stepped out onto a small table of stone above a chasm into which the water tumbled. In the shaded light of mid-morning, I watched the massive emerald and white and turquoise flume from mere yards away. It was like levitating. What I heard in its roar were spirit songs, the voices of my people in celebration of that pure, fluid power. Later in the living room of his suite, I spent the afternoon and early evening with Norval Morso talking about art and music and the spiritual and traditional ways of the Ojibwe. I spent the winter of 1996 plowing through prairie snow along the cliffs above the North Saskatchewan River. I was teaching in Saskatoon, and I walked there to clear my head. The wind was raw and cutting, and it was through tears that I saw the bend of that river, felt its muscle from 300 feet away. I heard its sibilant call to Hudson Bay, the echoed shouts of Indians and voyageurs riding on the crystal fog of ice. I stayed with my friends Andy Sett and Michael Finley that winter. She owned a bookstore, and he taught at the university. Along with their son and daughter and Anne's mother, they welcomed me into their home. It was a sad time for me then, and walking eased the hurt. I'd plod through the winter chill, knee deep in fresh prairie snow, and returned to feel the warmth of welcome at their door. The light of their friendship was a song in itself. In 1998, I spent 5 days in a canoe with an Inuk man named Enoch. We paddled a course of portages that the Algonquin people used to navigate their way through the territory north of Maniwaki, Quebec. There was a dozen of us in six canoes under the guidance of Algonquin guides and elders. We paddled across a wide lake in a raging windstorm. Enoch and I battled mightily with waves higher than the gunwales of the canoe. Rain soaked us to the skin in the shelter of a horseshoe bay. We drank black tea and felt the wind calm. That afternoon, we shot a rapid, both of us, energized by the challenge. We emerged into a long, flat cove where we fished and rested. We camped that night on a mossy rock bluff surrounded by huge firs and pines. In the light of the fire, I heard stories of an Inuk life. I heard music in the soughing of the wind through the trees, the soft slap of water at the foot of the bluff, and the call of loons. The sheer loneliness that is the north and the comfort of a voice in the glow of firelight were grace notes all around us. There is a song that is Canada. You can hear it in the bush and tree and rock, in the crash of a Pacific surf and the blowing of the breeze across a prairie sky. There are ancient notes in its chorus. Voices sprung from Métis roots, Ojibwe, Cree, Mi'kmaq, and then French, German, Scottish, and English. It's a magnificent cacophony. I've learned that to love this country means to love its people, all of them. When we say all my relations, it's meant in a teaching way to rekindle the to rekindle community. We are part of the great grand circle of humanity, and we need each other. It wouldn't be Canada with one voice less. That line, I have learned that to love this country means to love its people, all of them. And that brings to me, to my mind, the idea, you know, we have of seeing everyone as Buddha, because this is ultimately who and what we are. And when we see everyone as Buddha, the color of their skin, their religion, their sexuality, their socioeconomic standing, it's just so not important. So I just find it really interesting to see, you know, in these native teachings, it's the same as what we practice in Zen Buddhism. Years ago, I participated in a sweat lodge. And whenever a piece of firewood was put on the fire, we were taught to say, all my relations. And I don't remember it really being explained at the time, but I know it was meant to be a sign of respect. And I looked into it, and it's a phrase of the Lakota Sioux people, which, and I quote, reflects the worldview interconnectedness. The phrase, all my relations, can be translated as all my relatives, or we are all related. It describes oneness and harmony with all forms of life, people, animals, insects, trees, rocks, rivers, and mountains. This may sound familiar to us, right? So this story is called Wind is the Carrier of Song. Wind is a carrier of song. There's a push from the west that sends cumulus banks over the top of the mountain. And in it is the plunge and roll of surf 500 miles off. The wind in the reeds and grasses sings a higher register. It's a whistle of river valleys and the descant sweep of air across the delta. Days when the wind blows from the north, there's the keening pitch of the barren lands and the basso rumble of thunder in the peaks of a place where even the wind is lonely. Easterly flows bring the slicing soprano born in the unfinished area of plain and prairie. The south is a contralto, warm, luxuriant, rising off distant beaches. My people say the wind is Mother Earth, brushing her hair. If you've ever seen the dance of branch and stalk and foliage, you'll know it's an apt image, the tresses of her, alive with motion, singing with spirit. They also say the wind is eternal. Within it are born the sighs and whispers of ancestors. Within it is the exhalation with which Creator blew life into the universe. To take the wind into us, to fill our lungs with it, is to hold time as a breath. Every living thing is joined in this way. We breathe each other. When I feel the wind on my face now at age 53, I feel time and story and song. In 1955, when I was born, Status Indians were still not allowed to vote in Canada, even though we volunteered by the thousands to fight for the country in two world wars. We were exempt from conscription, but we went anyway. Our soldiers returned as decorated heroes to a country that did not recognize our people as full citizens. In the legislation that regulated our lives, the Indian Act, it stated that person was defined as anyone other than an Indian. We were not people. Our humanity was dismissed. We needed to get permission to do things that our non-native neighbors took for granted. It used to be that we were not allowed to gather in public. We were not allowed to hire a lawyer, organize politically, or leave the reserve without permission. The houses we lived in were not ours. They were owned by the government as was a land they sat on. We were paid dutifully the $5 annually that was ours by treaty. We were supposed to get ammunition too, but that never happened. Things changed after 1960. We finally gained the right to vote, the right to free assembly, permission to organize political groups. We were able to travel to and fro without restriction. We'd become citizens. All of this happened without my knowledge. I was, like most other Canadians, oblivious to the events shaping the lives of my native neighbors. My adopted family did not see the need for me to mingle with my own people or learn my history. Like everyone, I got only the accepted version of Canada. In 1969, a future prime minister penned the White House on Indian policy. Jean Chrétien wanted to scuttle anything that allowed us to identify ourselves as valid nations of people. He wanted to repeal the Indian Act, dismantle the bureaucracy that maintained it, abrogate the treaties, pat us on the head, and send us out into the mainstream. It's called assimilation. He called it forward thinking. I was 13, almost 14 at the time, worried about girls, fitting in, girls, belonging, girls, wearing what was cool. No one told me what Chrétien proposed. No one told me what it meant. No one told me how it might affect me. No one offered anything but a resolute marching on behind the flutter of the flag. The white paper changed everything. Instead of going away, my people became more present. We began showing up at universities and colleges in greater numbers. It wasn't long before we had doctors, lawyers, teachers, journalists, and politicians. Our political organizations gained strength and vision. We became a force for change in our country. By 1973, I was on the road, busy trying to survive. Life was about the search for security, meaning, and definition. Like everyone else, I concentrated on myself and my needs. Only when I reconnected with my native family did I open my eyes. What I saw was a people empowered. I saw people dedicated to showing that self-government was not something to be granted. It was something we were born with. I saw pride and focus and healing. I saw how much history I'd missed, my people's and Canada's. The two were intertwined, and I undertook to unravel that history to see each strand clearly. I understood how blind my self-centeredness and self-concern had made me, how little I understood the real story. In this, I was just like everyone else. What I learned made me proud of Native people, proud to be a part of the great grand story that is my people's history with Canada. What I learned in the end made me proud to be Canadian. We've endured it all together, and we've become stronger because of it, even if we don't readily see that. The wind is the carrier of song. When it blows across this mountain lake, it bears the essence of the land and its people. The essence of time past, time present, time future. It is our breath, everyone's. So there's many references to nature in Wakamese's writing. And it's such a touchstone for himself, but also, as he points out, the foundation of Indigenous culture and spirituality. And this particular reminds me of our Mountains and Waters session that's actually coming up in July, where we consciously embrace nature, sitting and walking outside with the trees, the rocks, the water, the flora, and the fauna. And feeling that connection and oneness that we share with everything. So I found it interesting to see this sameness of the teachings of the elders with what we practice in our Zen practice. As Zen emphasizes nature and the importance of it in life and practice. And again, I like to think that we share this deep appreciation of nature with our Indigenous brothers and sisters. And there is also another a line in that story that stood out for me where he says, he tells us that his people say that the wind is permanent. Our Zen ancestors said this as well, related in this koan. Zen Master Boshe of Mount Mayu was fanning himself. A monk approached and said, "Master, the nature of wind is permanent, and there's no place it does not reach. Why then do you fan yourself? Although you understand the nature of the wind is permanent," Boshe replied, "you do not understand the meaning of its reaching everywhere." "What is the meaning of its reaching everywhere?" asked the monk again. The master just kept fanning himself. The monk bowed deeply. So I guess in conclusion, to me, Richard Wagamese was and is a bridge between Indigenous and non-Indigenous worlds. And he managed to thrive in both Native and non-Native, Native and non-Native worlds, despite the trauma and abuse he suffered. And also what strikes me about him is he's neither bitter or angry. And it also is something that I've noticed in a lot of the, Native people that I've had the pleasure to meet and work with. They, despite what they've been through, they generally have a lot of humility and don't seem so bitter and angry, which somewhat surprises me actually. And he, through storytelling and his writing, he's really able to sort of teach us and bring the cultures together. He appeals to our common humanity. I'm really proud to be a Canadian, very grateful that I live in a country with so much freedom and high standard of living and access to good health care and education. And there is so much to celebrate. But I don't want to forget about the Indigenous Canadians who not only haven't had the same freedoms and opportunities that I have or we have, but have suffered from and still face significant discrimination. And given what's happening now, right now in Canada as we speak, and when I wrote this, I was thinking of the burial sites that have been discovered in Kamloops and then Saskatchewan. And then even after I, typed out my few notes, there's been 182 more burial sites found in a place near Cranbrook. And so Native Canadians they're grieving right now, and they're really being re-traumatized by these discoveries. So I'd like to encourage us to keep them in our hearts and our thoughts. And tomorrow on Canada Day, I will wear my orange shirt in solidarity with them and think about how I can be a better ally and friend to them. So thank you for listening. And how many people are we here?